And he has also filed a summary of evidence, which I understand you have a copy of.
We do.
Thank you. I'll ask Mr. Faulkner to read his summary to you and then answer any questions you may have.
Right. Good afternoon. Get straight into it. So I've been engaged by Queenstown Lakes District Council to provide evidence in relation to urban zone matters regarding the zoning requests in the Upper Clutha area of Queenstown Lakes District. My rebuttal evidence is provided in response to the evidence of Ms. Jill Corson and Mr. Ian Reeves for Arena Propriety Limited submission. Is that property or?
Proprietary, I think.
Oh, it is, yeah, proprietary. Okay. My focus has been on Ms. Corson's evidence along Brownston and Russell Streets, where the submitter proposes that the notified medium density residential zone, it's the MDR, along with the Wanaka Town Centre Transition Overlay, the TCTO, the rezoned Town Centre Zone. Now, whilst I appreciate the vision-led approach in Ms. Corson's evidence, I do not believe the site analysis is thorough enough in order to justify the rezoning in the manner sought by the submitter. There is a substantial contour change along Brownston Street, with an uphill section that includes Russell Street and a drop in elevation toward Bullock Creek and Help Street that creates two visually distinct areas. In terms of the built form, there also appears to be plenty of gaps and redevelopment sites within the existing town centre and along the northern side of Brownston Street. There does not appear to be a capacity issue, nor does the northern edge of Brownston Street exhibit a built-to-the-edge town centre type of character. I agree with Ms. Corson at paragraph 19 that Brownston Street has a core arterial function that links Cadrona and Queenstown entrance into Wanaka and that of the Luggett and Cromwell entrance, and that the present standard of development has a lot to be desired. However, I do not consider Russell Street should be considered a part of or in the same way as Brownston Street. In my opinion, the cross-section shown in the guidelines, the Town Centre guidelines, is an appropriate urban design outcome for Brownston Street. This provides for a high quality streetscape which includes footpaths, lighting poles and street trees. I suggest that the requirement for high quality urban design for applications that have variants already present in the MDR, TCTO zone provisions will stimulate good development and should be extended to all of applications in the zone. Ms. Corson proposes a rear service lane and offers a greater setback from adjacent residential to compensate for a slightly higher built limit. But as it does not exist, it is not clear how this will be formed. Ms. Corson is also vague on how Russell Street and Bullock Creek would be enhanced. Mr. Greaves echoes many of Ms. Corson's themes and contends that MDR, TCTO zoning will result in poorly designed and inefficiently laid out commercial development, and that, as a result, key commercial and visitor accommodation development may be pushed to the outlying areas. I do not consider that the built form resulting from this MDR TCTO zoning will necessarily result in poor quality development. Mr. Greaves believes that without mandatory requirement for reference to the guidelines in the urban design panel, the design of the buildings in the TCTO will not be subject to sufficient rigour. Whilst this may be true to a degree, it does not follow that they will result in poorly designed buildings. In conclusion, I consider that the MDR TCTO provisions, which allow for setbacks from the front, side and rear of the individual properties, are sufficient to provide a more spacious urban fabric and a greater spatial transition to the adjacent residential. Also, a quality streetscape can be developed along Brownston Street and along Russell Street that reflects this transitional context, rather than the rules that enable a more built-up town centre form along the street edge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Faulkner. Commissioner Munro.
Thank you. Mr. Faulkner, just a couple of questions. One could conclude from Ms. Corson's work that a key justification or benefit she sees is the ability of achieving a degree of symmetry on each sides of the street. When I think about Brownston Street opposite Pembroke Park, there are very different outcomes on each side of the street. If I think about Ardmore Street, there are very different outcomes on each side of the street. I'm I'm interested in your thoughts on the significance in urban design terms, and specifically to the strategic directions of what the PDP is going to achieve.
Mm.
How important is the achievement of symmetrical streets?
Yeah, that's a good point. And the symmetry, the balance, I think she uses the term, and her evidence is driven by her vision of that street, that cross-section of it. Built edge on each side, roughly the same scale in that. I think that there's a degree of balance within the cross-section that's shown in the guidelines, which is framed by the poles and the lights, etc., and the slight setback on the southern side, which is that greater transition which I talk about. So I don't think it needs to be absolutely symmetrical or absolutely in balance. I mean, there's a lot of imbalance in the Wanaka town centre. We've got upper Ardmore, we've got lower Ardmore and Halk Street, separated. In the diagram that I've provided, the figure ground, you can see just how many gaps and setbacks are existing already on the northern side. So the northern side's hardly built to the edge and hardly in balance, I would say.
Thank you. Your understanding of the proposed medium density zone and overlay that the council seeks or prefers for that land, if all the landowners got together and shared a common vision and decided to put a rear lane in for their mutual benefit, and maybe think about even contravening the front yard control, given that resource consent's required for any building under any of the zone scenarios anyway, would it be possible under the council's medium density overlay approach to achieve an outcome similar to what Ms. Corson envisages?
To amalgamate the sites, to achieve the air service map?
Achieve a general, but all the things she showed in her cross section. Commercial at the ground floor, I understand, is commercial is permitted, I think, in the medium density overlay.
Yes,
so with the exception of the built form permitted activity limits, but they don't really matter because everything is restricted discretionary activity as a starting point anyway.
Mm.
I'm trying to understand what is it that the town centre zone offers that motivated landowners couldn't otherwise achieve using the council's medium density zone anyway.
I think it's essentially that built to the property.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm familiar, as I'm sure you can imagine, that one approach to urbanism and transitions is to think about hard edges between different activities or an edge of town or an industrial zone or a residential zone. And
another approach is the idea of this transition, the graduation. And it seems, as I read the PDP and the council's evidence in support of the medium density overlay, that its approach is favouring the transition from residential through this overlay area to the town centre proper. Have I got that right?
Yeah, essentially, I think. And the transition allows for not only a greater transition spatially and built form, but also use-wise.
Yeah, well, the question following on from that is, were we to agree with the submitter that the land would be most appropriately zoned as part of the town centre, does it not create a concurrent deficiency that the transition in terms of a medium density housing, more domestic form, different type of activities as you describe, still needs a home that then would not be being provided?
And Ms. Corson's view is that transition happens at the rear boundary.
Now, what I'm suggesting is there, would there still be a need for some form of medium density housing type overlay that allowed effectively the commercial use of residential buildings, which is one of the things that the council's proposal
set back from this.
So perhaps on the other half of the block, for instance, to achieve the same transition of activity, density and intensity that you've described the council's trying to achieve.
Yeah. I don't think that would be appropriate because that would be facing residential.
Now, I'm not putting it to you as a proposition. I'm suggesting if we agreed to take out the medium density housing overlay and make it part of the town centre out, does it create a deficiency at the edge between the residential zone and the town centre zone? Okay, it's a back boundary and a front boundary.
Yeah, yeah. I take it as you noted at the beginning of your question that there's two different schools. The greater transition and the sharp, hard edge transition. I think Ms. Coulson's promoting the hard edge. The current proposal in the proposed district plan is for that transition, so they are not to be mixed.
A point of clarification. I wonder if Mr. Barr could assist us. My recollection is that one of the submitters did seek, either Lorena or Sneaky Curlew did seek effectively Commissioner Munro's proposition to shift the transition backwards. Have I got that right?
Sorry, so you
missed
to defer that to Ms. Jones?
Yeah, sorry. Wrong matter. Oh, good thought.
Alright, winding up then. It seems that I'll start again. You've worked across the country, and I understand you're heading off to China soon. That's presumably that's for work or whatever it's for. Have you had experience in jurisdictions where there was no requirement for parking or vehicle access, but individual landowners still went ahead and provided them anyway for themselves?
Good question. I think overall, current revisions of district and city plans around the country, there's a pattern of reducing parking requirements, frustrating parking. It's part of the strategy to get people using their feet and cycles and public transport, etc. I'm thinking actually of Matakana, a small rural service town north of Auckland that's become quite a destination, and parking has been provided by the private landowner to cater for the influx. That's a voluntary thing, but reasonably rare, I think.
Given the nature of land ownership in the overlay area, and that as I understand the proposed rules that the submitter's nominated, and you might clarify if I've got it wrong, as you understand it anyway, that while there would be opportunity to form things like rear lanes, there's no actual requirement proposed. There's no requirement stopping each landowner still making its own vehicle access way, still providing its own car parking if they want.
Yeah, and in my evidence, I point out to a similar Paradiso, which to me has an interesting parking layout, and it is formed to entry and exit access from the street and rear and side parking, which frames the building. The building still addresses the street. But effectively, a rear lane has been formed in that situation.
Do you think it's a realistic scenario that were we to support or recommend the council agree with the submitter on the premise of the superiority of the outcome that the submitter's experts are promoting, that the land could nonetheless still be developed as a series of individual sites without rear lanes, without comprehensive access, without all the things that have been promoted by the submitter's experts as reasons why one would support the rezoning in the first place? Is that a realistic risk?
I think there's a real danger because you just don't have control over those individual lots.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Mr. Duncan.
Commissioner Hudson?
No,
I won't ask Commissioner McLeod, since this is the area of his conflict. I only had one question for you, Faulkner, and that's about the juxtaposition of urban design and traffic planning, which, of course, you're an expert in half of. That, given my understanding, and that Brownson Street is intended to be an arterial roadway, imagine in the fullness of time possibly taking over from Lower Ardmore Street, and you can see that happening. Mm. What urban design is most appropriate given that arterial road function,
yes,
in terms of the options on the table?
So it is performing an arterial function now. It's essentially a bypass to the town centre between the southern and the northern entrances. Arterial function, in my reading, is the easy movement, the free flow of not only vehicle but I guess cycle traffic as well, between those two entrances. The submitter proposes parallel parking and an amalgamation of entrances, vehicle drop curbs. I think she mentions that would ease traffic congestion. My understanding is, and you're right, I have to be careful of how far I go with traffic design thinking, but the more you constrict a road reserve and the more activity you put on that road reserve, the more parking you put on that road reserve, the slower the traffic is going to be. And hence I would think that would work counter to that core arterial function of Brownson Street.
That's all from us, other than to wish you a successful and pleasant visit to China.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, going back to my legal submissions, I just wanted to make one quick correction before I move on. The corrections in relation to Beresford. You asked me a question about whether there are any issues in relation to the ONL because of the revised relief. My understanding is that Beresford is still seeking some low density residential within the agreed location for the ONL. So I didn't want to mislead you in that respect.
I think, my recollection, it might be large lot residential, and again, I may have mislead you, because when you said that, it came back to my memory that perhaps the situation is that Mr. Beresford's landscape architect has recommended development in one place, and Mr. Crystal's plans and extend into the ONL as recommended by Mr. Field and agreed by Ms. Melson.
That is exactly it. Yes, it is. So Mr. Crystal's evidence doesn't align with his landscape experts. That's
yes.
Correct.
Yes, well, indeed, that is something, but in the fullness of time, we can discuss with Mr. Griffiths.
Yes, thank you. So, turning back, we were on page 15. I've just noted two particular submissions where there are some scope issues. The first is Allenby Farms, and I simply note there that a minute has been issued directed to legal counsel for Allenby asking that they address the panel on the jurisdiction to entertain the revised relief that's set out in Allenby Farms evidence. That is noted, and we will wait to hear from the legal counsel about that. The second... Thank you.
Before you go on, before you leave Allenby, I've got a much more general question for you about Allenby. And that's whether you have any view on whether the, what I would describe as the environmental compensation approach that's inherent in the LMB proposition is available in a plan setting. Clearly it's available in a resource consent setting, and you only have to look as far as Parkins Bay to see it in action.
Yes.
But what about in a plan setting?
So that was something we've been speaking about, and we were going to cover in our reply if it was pursued by the by legal counsel. There is a suggestion in Mr. Barr, well, not suggestion, but he essentially, in his rebuttal evidence, reflects that the submitter is essentially seeking a consent and is using the environmental compensation concept as part of justification for the plan change. I don't believe it is relevant to the plan change context. It is a consenting principle, but I would like to look at that in more detail. It's not something that's been covered by us at this point in time. I do understand that it will be addressed by legal counsel for LMB at the hearing.
Well, I understand your response. Suffice it to say, I'll be interested in whether there is any authority that would that provides a case example of that in action, or alternatively saying that it's not available.
Yes. What I suggest is I come back to you this week on that.
Well, like if you propose it to deal with the reply, yeah, happy to leave on that basis. It's clearly a question I'll be asking Mr. Goldsmith.
Yes, I'm sure you will. In relation to Ranch Royale, there was a scope concern mentioned in the council's rebuttal evidence, which is why this has been addressed in these submissions in detail. I think, essentially, to summarise, the council's comfortable that the revised relief, or the relief that they're seeking, is, or the revised relief is within the scope of their original submission. So the council's not opposing opposing that rezoning based on scope.
The question I had reading the two purposes is that if they sought TP tourism, which as you describe it, tourist facilities, conference centres, community facilities, and compare LDR, which is about houses, while the density may be the same, is it relevant that the use is different, or is the point more not just that the intensity is less, but that the use will be have a lower impact?
The type of activity is relevant as well. I have to admit, sir, I thought we had looked into the type of activity and what is actually provided for, as well as the stated purpose of the subzone. Which obviously goes into more detail when you look at the actual rules. But no, the answer to your question is yes, activity type is relevant, as well as the likely density allowed for under the different zones.
I have to confess that I didn't get time to go and look at the zones. I was just going on the two purposes as you quoted them in 528. That look quite different.
But they do, indeed. So, with your leave, I might just take another look at that in terms of the actual activities that are provided, that is really relevant and is acknowledged. What is set out here is that the standards, the density provided in each is okay from a scope perspective.
We're happy to leave you to think further about it.
Yes, I suspect it's something that legal counsel for Ranch Royale may be addressing as well. Turning to the Apakluta Environmental Society.
Sorry, before you move on, just on the Ranch Royal thing you're going to think about, could you just add to the mix Mr. Barr's recommendation, which is for neither of those zones, but the large lot residential zone instead? Thanks.
Thank you.
Can I cut you off before you start talking about the UCES? I wrote in large letters in the bottom of my page, this isn't our issue, is it?
That was going to be my question to you now. It is not your issue. The memorandum has been filed in this hearing stream, so I just wanted to get the council's position on paper.
Well, the irony is that I wasn't aware that the memo existed until you mentioned it.
Okay.
And it's addressed to the council's strategy committee. And even if it were addressed to us, it's about the substance of the subdivision rules and the note of the rules related.
Yes.
So it would be a matter for stream four, where Mr. Howarth has already made that submission.
Yes, that's correct. When the society comes and presents its submission, its evidence does go through a number of matters that they have already presented to the panel on, and my understanding is that they will present to the panel on this as well, hence why Council's position is simply outlined here, perhaps for the Society's benefit more than anyone else's.
Well, we'll take it from Rep, but I do have a scope issue about the Society's position.
Yes.
The argument the Society is running, as I understand it, is that given the inadequacies of the O&L lines in the particular locations identified, the whole O&L line should be thrown out, or they should be made indicative only. And that was, as I recall, what's in their submission. Do you think they have scope, by reason of their submission, to pursue the alternative position, which is if you have O&L lines, that in the particular examples given, they should be shifted?
Any thought until now.
Clearly your landscape team have addressed the issue on merits,
yes,
which is appropriate, but in terms of a legal and planning argument, do they have scope? If you haven't thought about it, suggest you add that to your list of things to ponder.
Thank you, I will do that. So moving right on, I think I only have one section left that relates to the proposed Glendo Station Zone, which is a new zone being pursued at over 3,000 hectares at Glendo Bay. The site is zoned rural in the proposed district plan and is entirely within an O&L. Mr. Ferguson's evidence has described the consenting history of the site in detail, and he has explained that the consent holder is in the early stages of implementing the land use consent and that the sequencing or staging of the consent has proved unrealistic, requiring a range of variations and new consents. His evidence is that the resource consent process has high administration and transactional costs and that the land can be managed in a more practical and workable way than by adherence to consent conditions. His evidence goes on to give details of his proposed Glendo Station Zone. So the evidence that has been provided by the submitter is quite detailed, but the council's key concern really is that it justifies the extent of activity as currently consented, but in various places it fails to address the additional effects that are being sought by and in the special zone. And there is a gap in that analysis. So what has been consented is is generally okay from the council's perspective. We have some issues as to how that is replicated into planning provisions, given the very detailed consent conditions that are there, and I mean they really are quite detailed. We're talking about vegetated roofs, etc., on the house sites. But the council's concern has been twofold. One is the additional activity that's been pursued, and two is how you actually turn complicated consents into a framework within the plan. Mr. Barr has gone to the efforts of making comments on the proposed Glenview Station zone as to areas where he thinks there could be some changes, and he has suggested various ways of fixing that. That is attached to his rebuttal evidence.
I have two questions about your position on Glenview Bay, Scott. Taking your last point, and this is putting aside the additional activities, which are something we'll have to get our head around. Do you and/or Mr. Barr think that the defects in Mr. Ferguson's draft zoning provisions are fundamental, or are they a matter of pushing, shoving, massaging? And if it's the latter, what would your reaction be if I suggested that this would seem to be the sort of issue that the two senior planners on either side should be caucusing about? That prospect may alter Mr. Barr's view on the first question, but.
The council wouldn't want to be left behind in terms of advancing any potential provisions, irrespective of what the panel's ultimate recommendation might be. So the officers would be more than happy to assist with further drafting suggestions.
Well, hold that thought, and I'll ask the same question to council for Glenview Bay in due course. The second point is, Scott, is the statement about two sentences into your 6.3. The council accepts the effects associated with the consent form part of the existing environment. And during the course of reading the planning evidence, I noted a citation of a case that I hadn't read, being a decision of Justice Fogarty's in Shotover Park, where he said precisely the opposite. That there is no existing environment in a plan setting, and there's certainly no existing environment formed by unimplemented consents.
That's an interesting comment, sir. We have been debating this earlier last week in the scary subzone hearing. There are differing views as to whether it's the council is required to take into account the Hawthorne existing environment concept in a plan review. Or whether it can do that, if of course the consent is likely to be implemented. The summary of Justice Fogarty's quite clearly says that the council is not required to do that. The one reason it gives there is that that is because the existing environment Hawthorne concept was created for resource consents, and here we are dealing with a plan change, which is a different statutory test. If you go on into the decision, the Shotover Park decision, Justice Fogarty does then go to, if I am wrong, he then proceeds to set out what his view is on whether the consents in that situation were likely to be implemented. They were under appeal in another court, and he came to the conclusion that they weren't likely to be implemented. Taking a step back in terms of what that means, The relevance of that case for Glendhu Bay, so we have this consent, I think we all accept that it's likely to be implemented, it's already partway there. What it means from the council's perspective is that it wouldn't be fair to basically say, well, you've got this much of a consent, you can now, the door's now open to get even more. So you need to take into account the background to that consent. It was a non-compliant consent application to get the level of activity that they have been able to. There is very detailed and prescriptive consent conditions sitting beside that. And the council's position is that the panel shouldn't lose sight of the details that had to go into that consent to allow them to get that level of activity. There's also a case, the King Family Trust in Hamilton City Council, and that case is a plan change hearing, and there is an existing consent for a supermarket, and the court is considering whether or not to how much weight basically to place on the existence of that existing consent. I think there was evidence there that it was likely to be implemented, and the Environment Court essentially held that consent for a commercial activity shouldn't be used as a springboard for additional development.
The interesting thing is, of course, that using an existing consent as a springboard, to my mind, is what the existing environment is about. It's just measuring the incremental effect over and above what's already consented, rather than starting at ground zero. So you said it wouldn't be fair to leverage the existing position upwards, which I would have said was saying that the existing environment shouldn't apply, which is the opposite of what you've got in print. So perhaps you'd like to clarify.
Well, I mean, the council accepts that the consent is there, and that it does form part of the existing environment. The Shotover case does leave the door open, and it does let the council use the Hawthorne existing environment concept in a plan change. It doesn't say that it cannot do that. What the council's position is that because we have this consent and it's sitting at this level, that doesn't mean that any additional level of activity is appropriate. So we're acknowledging what has been consented, but the council isn't satisfied that the submitter has provided sufficient evidence to justify the additional effects that will result from the additional activities being pursued. By way of example, there were, I might get the numbers wrong, but I think there were around 32 house sites. I apologise.
42 versus 50 now. So
yes. So 42. The submitter sought 50 through the consent application. That was turned down by the council and also declined by the Environment Court. So the consent is for 42, whereas through this rezoning, the submitter is seeking the additional 8, but there's no clear evidence justifying those additional home sites within the zone.
They're trying to get clear in my own mind what you're saying. I think that what you're saying is that you're not seeking, you wouldn't seek on behalf of the council to reopen the merits of granting consent for what is currently consented in there by way of it. So if it were possible to take exactly what's been consented and move it straight into the plan, suspension of disbelief in terms of the way the different documents are. But if it were if it were able to be translated down to the last line, you wouldn't have an issue with that in terms of the acceptability or appropriateness of the outcome. Have I got that right?
I think you do, sir, but that's not to say that just because a consent exists for some activity doesn't mean that you should go about rezoning areas of land to reflect that particular zone, that particular consented activity. There is a history to how that consent came about. It's non-compliant within the rural zone in an ONL. So the council's acknowledging where we've got to, but its position is we shouldn't be going any further. It also has, and this is the second limb, some issues with how that's reflected in the plan. I think Mr. Barr's evidence endeavours to reflect that he is willing to work with the submitter in terms of the level of activity that's been consented, but I think he's quite clear that he's not at all comfortable with any more.
I understand. That, if we do get as far as inviting him to caucus with Mr. Ferguson, it will clearly be on without prejudice to what it is that is ultimately provided for in the plan.
Yes. Mr. Barr is looking at me uncertainly, and I wonder if he wants to add anything.
Feel free. You'll have lots of other options.
Yes, yeah, so well, I think I'll just wait until my time thinks it.
Right.
Without throwing a spanner in the works on that one, I was interested in the council's view on, and it's not something that's been addressed in evidence, hence I ask the question now, the proposition of an applicant that has sought of its own accord resource consents, effectively being bound by an equivalent of OGA, to then say the consents it decided how many, what scale of development it sought through the consent. It determined, presumably by not asking the council for a longer time frame or any particular combination of conditions to ease the administrative burden, for it to then say it's actually bitten off more than it chose to chew for itself, and that therefore is the grounds for the council to provide an alternative mechanism. I thought the council would have something to say about that.
I think Mr. Barr touches on that in his evidence, where he, I think his evidence is that Mr. Ferguson hasn't considered the benefits and costs of looking to vary the consent. That's a bit of a throwaway comment. It's too hard. Submitter's throwaway comment. It's too hard, so we're just going to try and do this through a plan change.
Well, Scott, I was going to ask you a couple of questions arising out of your appendix too, but if you have any final comments before we go there, by all means.
I have one. It relates to the evidence of Ms. Hanson that's been filed on dwelling capacity. That evidence questions the projections of population increases in the district, and set out in Mr. Barr's supplementary evidence on dwelling capacity how it has used estimates put together by Rationale.
Excuse me, I need to check the heating for you so you don't get cold. Are you okay with that? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the council has used population estimates put together by Rationale. We haven't filed any evidence about those population estimates, and they have been questioned by Ms. Hampson in her evidence. There is, we would be able to put together an evidence, a statement of evidence from Rationale and get them before the panel if that is something that the panel would be interested in. It might be something you'd like to think about, but we can do that. We are going to be doing that for the Queenstown hearing, but I am conscious that it is different hearings panels. So if possible, I would like to try and get that before this panel.
I think you'd readily recognise that that produces rather of a procedural problem, given that the evidence on that subject was set up, as you requested, on a council evidence and rebuttal via the submitter basis. I would be loath personally to reopen, have firstly rebuttal and no doubt in the fullness of time and an application to be able to rebut the rebuttal on the rebuttal. That I'll talk to my fellow commissioners and will give you a view, but
yes,
I should signal that I'm not at all comfortable.
Yes, thank
with
you.
With a further evidence round.
Yes, any suggestion of that? Clearly, we would anticipate that submitters would be given an opportunity to respond. Mr. Barr has also covered the rationale projections to some extent and will be available to answer some questions. I just wanted to raise that with you.
I understand. I'll discuss it with the commissioners and I'll give you our concluded view in the morning.
That's fine, thank you.
And going to Appendix 2, two issues. The first is, does motor machinists apply in this situation? Should we be inquiring in every case whether the zone in the plan is different to the ODP, and if it's not, declining to consider any suggestions that it be changed?
The relevance of motor machinists for this hearing is really the boundaries of the rezoning being pursued.
So
I don't think you can take it much further, really. There are well, actually, there is one particular point. There were some rezonings which were made on land that has not been notified in Stage 1. Sorry, so it related to what we refer to as Stage 2 land. So it wasn't notified and it's not before the hearings panel. The council has taken an approach where that any submissions on that land is not on Stage 1 of the proposed district plan. That land will be notified in Stage, well, there are two options. That land will be notified in a later stage, and the submitter has an opportunity to submit on the appropriateness of the zoning. And there is, of course, some land which has been excluded from the plan review completely. And that will be remaining in Volume B of the plan, which is essentially the parts of the district that are not being reviewed.
Your answer here reminded me of a further point, but I think that would, but just to be clear, you're not saying, so to give you an example, the Makarora rural landscape zone has been rolled over. Mr. Barr is now advising or recommending that it be significantly pared back. If motor machinists apply, we wouldn't be able to entertain that recommendation because it hasn't changed, unless we could say that the rural lifestyle zone and the PDP is a different rural lifestyle zone to the ODP. That's the question behind That's where I'm going with that question. And I think what you're saying to me is that it doesn't apply with that effect. It applies to shut somebody out who wants to make submissions on zone, on stage two land.
Yes, my apologies. That is absolutely correct. I'm sorry if my answer was confusing. So we're talking about essentially lines drawn on the planning maps as to what is up for rezoning and what is not.
And the follow-up question, in relation to those zones or those areas that have been withdrawn from the plan recently by resolution of the council, like North Lake, the Three Parks, Peninsula Bay, clearly the zone issues that were previously an issue just melt away. My question for you is, does that mean that the O&L lines come off that land too? If they're like a black hole in our plan, does it follow that the O&L lines should be removed as well?
My understanding on that is no. The chair, another chair of the hearings panel, has issued a minute in the last couple of days that touches on this in Queenstown, and I am still to seek confirmed instructions from the council, but we will probably be filing something just to confirm what the council's position is in response to his minute that related to the airport and Remarkables Park zone. The landscape lines, the policy that directs that the O&Ls be shown on the planning map sits in Chapter 6. So I need to take a step back, there's a lot behind this. In terms of the structure of the plan, this was confirmed in a memorandum we filed, I think, in November last year. And essentially, what we're working towards is a two-volume plan. Volume one consists of the land that is being reviewed through the various stages, and then volume two will be land that is excluded from the review. Strategic chapters, so chapters 1, 3, 4, 5 and 6 apply to the entire district, which includes landscape, and it is the landscape chapter that sets up the framework for having O&Ls on the planning maps. So the council's approach to that is that they should be shown across the district, and they should simply shouldn't be rubbed down because they are across land which is excluded from the review. If you are seeking a consent on that land under the plan, of course the operative planning framework would apply, and then it's a matter, the existence of that line will need to be taken into account in that planning framework, which is different to the one that's been promoted for volume one.
I understand the substance of your position. If our fearless leader has issued a minute on the subject as it relates to Queenstown, I think, and you need to think about that, and I probably need to read what he said, so we might resume this discussion later in the week.
Yes, it's the decision's quite new. The minute's quite new. So it's just come up late on Friday.
Okay. The other question I have for you arises about an aspect of Ms. Malkoff's evidence. It's also a scope issue. Could I ask you to go to page 30 of her evidence, because you really have to have the diagram in front of you to understand the point I'm raising. This is about O&L lines on Hawthornden Farm. Ms. Millsop's recommending a varied O&L line. The submission this is responding to is effectively seeking that the O&L line be shifted up the hill, therefore to the bottom left. In Ms. Millsop's recommending that the line be shifted back in some places and down the hill in others, not by a long way. Question for you is, do we have scope to entertain a more constraining O&L line, or an O&L line that takes in more rather than less of the Hawthornden land?
The answer to that question might depend on the research I do in relation to the Upper Clifford submission this evening, sir. Based on the Hawthornden submission, I think the answer is no. But I would want to go away and read it again. You'll appreciate there's a few submissions and I don't want to.
I understand.
Yeah.
You don't want to tell me that there is no scope for something that Ms. Millsop believes is justified on a
merits
on a merits perspective, if you can find some.
Yes, that's right, sir. And I will certainly acknowledge if there isn't scope, but if I may look at that overnight as well.
Absolutely. Now, on the basis that it's 13 minutes to 5, do you want to start, Ms. Melson?
We were actually going to call Dr. Reed.
Dr. Reed, I'm sorry.
I still have some questions.
Oh, you are, sorry, I apologise. Well, that might solve that problem anyway. Commissioner.
Thank you. Just to round out these questions, I'm intending to put to the witnesses, but I'm interested in just understanding the council's view on some of these things as well. So I'll put them to you first, and of course, let's Mr. Barnum be part of what's coming ahead on. So, reading Ms. Banks' traffic evidence in particular, she frequently makes a lot of very specific recommendations. Add a footpath here, widen the road there, fix an intersection somewhere else. Bearing in mind we're looking at a plan change, not a resource consent, I want the council's view on how it's hoping we might deal with those recommendations, whether it's in the form of site-specific additional requirements, were we to agree with those submissions, assuming through this panel or whatever other any of the other constituted panels can achieve it, or whether we should just be asking ourselves whether the outcomes that are identified could be imposed through the subsequent resource consent requirements that the zone being sought would set in train. So it's really an extension to the discussion we had earlier about what the subdivision process, what the council actually has in mind about how we'll manage those effects. But that's just a particular example that applies across a number of submissions. So you might not have an answer now, I think, just add it to the mix.
Yes, thank you.
I wanted to ask the council's view of what it is trying to achieve or count through its capacity and NPS work. In particular, whether its focus is on individually habitable dwellings, whether in a detached or attached buildings, or whether it is interested in independently disposable titles. And so, for instance, if I owned a piece of land that was big enough to achieve density rules and so on, and it had two houses on it, albeit if it was only one title, would that count as two dwellings, or would it just count as one, reflecting the title?
I think the answer is the latter, but I will bring that question to Mr. Osborne's attention and ensure that he addresses that on Wednesday.
Where it's going, because I can ask Mr. Osborne myself, the analysis that I've seen from submitters' experts and the counters' experts evaluating potential zone uplift, and it talks about the yield that could be anticipated, none of them acknowledge the permitted residential flat that the council's proposing through the PDP would apply. So there'd be a house that I might live in, and a separate building that it seems the rules would make me free to rent out to whoever I wanted. And if that's not a dwelling for the purpose of counting dwellings, I'm not sure what would be. And so I've got a real lingering doubt about what the council's actually proposing along the lines. And it may well be that if it counts residential flats, its capacity might be quite somewhat more than it currently thinks.
Yes, well, that would fall in the council's favour. Point is noted as well. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll ask the experts what they think, but I'm very interested in the council's view of what it thinks we should be counting when we're thinking of yields and all these things with the different submission.
Yes, thank you.
In the case of, not to pick on this banks, but one example that's in my mind is she considered the merits from a transport perspective of, for instance, a Blennerhassett submission and a Willow Ridge submission from Stubham Road together. The trend of the officer evidence has been individual submission by individual submission. But inconsistently, there have been cases of grouping ones with like circumstances and effectively making recommendations together. I'm interested in the council's thoughts on whether jurisdictionally and or for any other reason, in our consideration of the submissions, were we to find that grouping, for instance, a contiguous, spatially contiguous group of submissions together and determining merit as a group could or should or would be appropriate.
And to run a curveball on that, the question I was going to ask Mrs. Banks, but it does have a legal fallback, was what, almost the example that Commissioner McGrath has in mind, if you disaggregate those two, would you find that one was acceptable from a traffic point of view and the other not? And if they were interchangeable, if either of them would be acceptable, how would you recommend we address the fact that, in effect, pick the winner?
Yes, I think Mr. Banks has considered the cumulative effects of the two rezonings together. The council is, of course, here making recommendations on all of the rezoning submissions, and it cannot pretend that right next door something else is up for grabs as well. So it needs to take that wider view. In terms of your specific question, Commissioner Munro, I think the answer is yes, you could make a recommendation that applies across the wider land, provided it's within scope of what each of the submitters individually seek. That would just mean one submission might be accepted, another might be accepted in part, but it might be ultimately a full package of relief for that area of land.
All right. Well, that's a very helpful direct response now anyway, thank you. But yeah, if you want to think about this a bit further, that's helped me too. I'm particularly thinking of the circumstance the panel might find itself in, where the relief sought by submitter A might be supportable, but only if the context of what submitter B wants was also supported. And I'm sure none of us would want to be in a position where we started being accused of jury-rigging our consideration of submissions to make it more favourable for submitter A by resolving submitter B first or vice versa, whereas being able to just consider them together might allow a more reasoned overall and integrated view to be taken, but it's not something that's really come through the officer evidence and how we should approach them.
Yes.
Okay, last comment from me. Again, the council's view is thought on the staff's or the officers and consultants' criteria for evaluating the rezoning. And in addition to those criteria, there were context factors that were also identified. I'm interested to know whether the council would be hoping we might adopt or agree with those considerations, or if not, whether the council is hoping we would, as a means of determining submissions, develop our own alternative. So what is the status of those criteria? And if they are not of themselves binding, for want of a better term, should we nonetheless be finding substitutes? Or is the panel able to do what it wants?
the rezoning assessment principles, I think that's what they're called, they're not binding on the panel. The council has used them sitting beside the statutory test that need to be achieved for...
Let me rephrase just one aspect of the question just on that point.
Sorry?
Are they the council's criteria that its officers and consultants have been asked to use in their evaluation of the submissions, or have they been entirely developed by the officers and consultants and the council has accepted them as part of the advice it's received?
So I think they've been developed by the council officers in their assessment of the rezonings. And that they have used the strategic directions, etc., all the other chapters in informing them.
And I think to close off that question, it links back to comments made earlier about generally how we should be approaching the rezonings in the council's view vis-a-vis
methods.
Methods or not, and how wide might the list of criteria be cast.
Yes.
But you can come back to us on.
Yes, thank you.
But I think that'll do for me. I'm sure you're pleased to hear. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Commissioner Munro.
So, having made that mistake, Commissioner Hanson, do you put anything on that? Only one last question. You didn't introduce your learner junior to us.
Oh, my apologies. I am hearing with Ms. McCullum, who has been doing a lot of work on the review, but this is her first visit to or appearance in one of these hearings.
Thank you. She's very welcome. It was a happy gathering.
I'm sorry.
It's, I think, 4 minutes to five. I don't think we'll trouble Dr. Reed tonight.
Thank you, sir. Just to give you some guidance on what I propose to do, we will start with Dr. Reed tomorrow morning, followed by Ms. Halsop, and then we'll turn to Mr. Glasner.
On that basis, I'll adjourn until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Same place, same chair.